From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, open lines here on Coast to Coast. Here's what's happening. A Mississippi man has been indicted for manslaughter several weeks after his eight-month-old daughter died in his hot car while he went in and worked. Jeez, 8 days after another young child died in a hot car in another Mississippi county. Now, the mother in the other case was not arrested and has not yet been charged. Look, folks, it's getting hot. We're in the summertime. Please do not leave kids or pets in your car. Just don't do it. Even if you think it's going to be a few minutes, don't do it. Well, there's another craze that's happening. The selfie is now killing more people annually than being attacked by sharks. That's right. People take selfies when they're cliff hiking and doing all kinds of things. And lately, they've been dying. They have been falling off cliffs. Tourists, a couple of them died in Peru taking selfies. They backed up, and over the cliff they went. Unbelievable. Be careful there. Wall Street opened a little lower today. Fear still seeping in about the Brexit, about the British folks leaving the European Union. What does that all mean to us economically? Let's check in with the expert, Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, are things calming down or not?
No, George, things are just getting stirred up. Brexit really does. It's a very strong signal that we're moving from what's called a unipolar world to a multipolar world. So the U.S. vision of being the global empire is not working whatsoever. So we're in for real institutional changes. And get ready for a banking crisis in Europe this summer.
Oh, boy. So when that happens, could it have a ripple effect here?
Yeah. We have a lot of different institutional changes to go through. So I think, as somebody said the other day on Wall Street, the new word is buy the shock. But, I think we're going to be hiccuping through the markets for quite some time here. And this is going to be a difficult summer because we're in a slowdown. And when the cash flows slow down, chairs get pulled. It's like a game of musical chairs. In Brexit, UK pulled a whole bunch of chairs.
Generally, before an election, is the economy solid or is it soft?
Well, the statistics like to say it's solid, but in fact, this time it is soft.
Okay, Catherine.
The Fed has been saying that has been looking for steady growth in the U.S. economy and saying they're going to bump interest rates. And as you can see, they've backed off both times this year so far.
Catherine's website, solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I.com. You're still putting out that incredible report, Catherine, aren't you?
No, I'm working on the second quarter wrap-up. It's great. It's going to be called Productivity, Prosperity, and the Popsicle Index.
I love it. All right, thanks, Catherine. Listen to this story. A Boston taxi driver was praised by police after he returned a $187,000 cash inheritance that was left in his cab over the weekend. How do you leave that kind of money in a cab? Raymond Buzzy McCoslin picked up an unidentified male passenger in downtown Boston. After he dropped the man off, he discovered a backpack in the back seat of the car. That's never a good thing, right? While searching the bag for identification, the cabbie discovered the cash, bound in stacks of $100, $50, and $20 bills, $187,000 worth. The man got his money back, and the taxi driver got a $100 reward for all of that. No jackpot winning ticket was sold in the latest Mega Millions drawing, increasing the prize now to an estimated $508 million, a half a billion dollars, folks. But why are people buying lottery tickets? It's a frenzy. Let's check in with our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter, what causes people to do this?
Well, you got the demographics and you got psychology. Demographics, George, it's mostly poor people. The lowest fifth of the economic ladder by 61% of the tickets. And it's sequestered in minority communities. And it's one of the concepts that people have is that the minority communities feel like it's the one place where the odds are the same for the rich and the poor. I think it has a lot to do with the economy and with the feeling of hopelessness in the economy. And people are, they take a desperate move or a hopeful move, or do something to give themselves some hope. But I also think a lot of people play for fun and excitement and to spice up lives that they feel need a little more excitement in it.
I think you're right. Peter, thank you. I always love your observations of life. I really do. Story we have in the news at coasttocoastam.com. And spend some time on our website. Take a look at some of the highlight pictures. They found a new little sea creature and everything else. But doctors in India have replaced a 12-year-old boy's damaged nose with a new one, which they grew on his forehead. And once it grew to a certain size, they cut it off and put it on his face. It's an amazing story. Go take a look at it. And in Kentucky, a 510-foot, $100 million Noah's Ark attraction built by Christians who say the biblical story really did happen is ready to open in Kentucky this week. They are really excited about this. So go take a look at that. Up next, a couple hours as we talk about TWA 800, the crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy. Jack Cashel back with us on Coast to Coast. It's nearing 20 years since that tragedy, and we're going to get Jack's theories and feedback next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Over the course of the next 10 days, we're going to be presenting you various thoughts and theories about TWA Flight 800, which went down July 17th, 1996, 20 years ago this month. It was a date that changed history. But what really happened behind there? You've heard us talk about various subjects with that. And, of course, Jack Cashel is one of our experts. One of his books, of course, First Strike, TWA Flight 800 and the Attack on America. And now he has a brand new one out called TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, The Conspiracy. Jack, my pleasure to bring you on the program with this book just coming out as well. Good to have you with us.
Hey, George, it's my pleasure. Yeah, the book just came out yesterday, so it's great timing. And, you know, we are looking at the 20th anniversary, and I think if we don't blow this open this year, I don't think we ever will.
I think you're right, and I find it unbelievable that it's been 20 years. Where has the time gone?
Yeah, and it's you would think that in that time we would have made a little more progress getting the major media interested in this story.
You know, the major media, Jack, once a story is on, and they don't go back to it. I mean, they move on to the next one, and they just don't follow up.
No, and they don't follow up much even when it's in the news. So it's, I mean, today the word conspiracy theorist is actually a translation of the old word reporter, you know, because we're the only people who are doing it.
Jack, I'm going to ask you to do something differently for us tonight. I'm going to ask you to put us on this plane, TWA Flight 800. We're in New York, and we're taking off. And I want you to give it to us from maybe the perspective of you being the pilot. What's happening on that plane?
Well, you know, it's just a really pleasant evening. It's, you know, something like, it's, I think, 71 degrees for a summer evening. It's described as cool. It's a clear, sunny night. It's just at the sunset. You're flying to Paris, which is, you know, a nice 5-6 hour ride across the Atlantic. There's nothing special about the evening at all. You have 230 people on board, which is only about half full. And you take off from JFK at 8:19 p.m. You know, you turn, you know, you sort of head, originally head west, and you cut back east. You're flying along the south coast of Long Island. It's very pretty.
And some people are dozing off already, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, you have 230 people on board. A lot of them are students, you know, who are going from Montoursville, Pennsylvania. You have 16 students and 5 chaperones from Montoursville High School, for instance. They're very excited. For many of them, I'm sure it's their first trip abroad, maybe even their first trip in an airplane. And at 12 minutes out, at 8:31 p.m., you're about 8 or 10 miles off the coast of Long Island, around the Hamptons. This is very, you know, popular shore.
And sure.
People up and down the coast. And at sunset, if you know how people are, at the shore, they're all out on a nice evening and all out watching. And then you're gone. Then there's not a word from the cockpit. There's not any indication from the flight data recorder as to what happens. You are gone from the sky. You are falling. And you realize if you're the pilot, you are probably conscious, and you realize that the back half of your plane isn't there.
Oh, my God.
You and the business class, first class, are plunging desperately into the sea.
Are we alive on the plane while it's plunging?
Yeah, I believe the pilots are. I believe the people in first class probably are. because most of the most catastrophic damage to people took place back where the plane separated. So that part of the plane is plunging into the sea. Meanwhile, you might have even caught a glimpse of the rest of the plane, you know, lumbering on for another, you know, however long momentum takes it before it too falls from the sky. And as it falls, it starts breaking apart. And as it breaks apart, the fuel in the wings catches on fire and turns into a massive fireball and falls into the sea. Now, from the 8 or 10 miles away, you got literally thousands of people on the beach, literally thousands, because 750 of them would give testimony to the FBI what they saw.
Hear anything, Jack? Do they hear an explosion?
Well, that's the interesting part. You know, the FBI would later insist that what happened was that people all heard something, and then they looked up, and they only saw the final 6 seconds of the plane plunging into the water. But in the book, TW-800, what I do is I take the 40 best eyewitnesses, you know, the 40 most observant eyewitnesses,
right?
And I go through, what did they hear? And in only 3 cases of the 40, do they hear what the FBI says they heard? In 14 of the cases, the FBI doesn't even ask them what they heard.
Oh my God!
So the notion of sound propagation analysis is sort of out the window. I mean, the CIA allegedly based their animation of what the witnesses saw on the sound analysis, but the FBI wasn't even asking what people heard.
I mean, I'm not even a plane crash investigator, Jack, and that's one of the first questions I ask you.
Well, the thing is, the FBI aren't plane crash investigators either. And they, you know, they seized this investigation illegally from the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB. And then some sounds are kind of are fascinating for what people did hear or feel. Many people, most particularly the man around whom the CIA built its animation, we'll talk more about him in a while, the man on the bridge, Mike Wire by name, he felt it. He and the guys on the bridge that are working on this bridge in West Hampton, they felt the bridge shake. You don't shake like
Was that kind of vibration and concussion that they felt from that far?
That's not the sound of the explosion. That's a sonic boom. I mean, that's about the only thing that could produce that kind of... Because Mike felt it. He said he felt it on his face. You know, he could feel the wave.
My gosh.
So that is... the sound is, you know... And people are all up and down. They're all different places. Some people are in the sky. You know, there were at least two helicopter pilots. There's another small... commercial pilot, you know, so another guy, a fellow who was actually a former Navy guy and a real guy who had done, you know, missile testing himself when he was in the Navy, was above it in U.S. Air, and a U.S. airplane crossing above Flight 800. He saw it from his perspective, so they weren't even in a position to hear anything.
And there's a Navy ship in the area? Is that true?
You know, the Jim Kallstrom, who was the head of the FBI investigation, would later report that a couple of flight attendants who had, you know, were along the beach said they saw a Navy vessel, large, you know, about 400 foot battleship gray with all the equipment. And he mentioned that. I've talked to several other witnesses who saw that ship also within an hour of the crash.
And I'm told, Jack, it was leaving the scene. You would think it would go towards the scene.
Well, that's what the radar picked up, and that's distressing, especially for people who know the rules of the sea. The one ship the FBI was unable to identify, of all the boats out there, was the biggest one.
Yeah.
And it was leaving the scene at 35 knots. They picked it up on radar. It was big enough to be picked up on radar. And it was only 3 miles from the crash when it happened, and it was heading in the wrong direction and just kept on heading.
I remember that night. I was watching CNN, as a matter of fact. And they talked about this plane literally falling from the sky. And my most immediate thought was, it's a bomb. Something has happened here. Something has taken this plane down. Planes like this, 747s, just don't fall from the sky like that. They just don't. And so when these pieces of the plane plunged into the ocean, did the cover-up begin right then, in your opinion?
Well, no, I think there was about an hour's worth of truth. And it's odd because I've talked to so many different kinds of people about this who had, you know, and I compare it, George, to the time when I was like 20 and I was kind of drunk and I went to watch the Indianapolis 500. And, you know, we just camped out in the infield overnight and I had, you know, if you've ever been,
I've been there.
You see about a quarter mile of track, right? And it's a 2.5 mile track.
Yeah.
So if someone said to me, hey, did you see that spectacular crash at the Indianapolis 500?
You don't see it.
I knew about it because I could have sort of caught a piece of it. And that's the people I talk to who've been involved, who've been willing to come forward, all have a piece of it. But I do know this, is that there was a video taken that night. And as far as I can understand, as far as I've been able to discern, and I think I'm saying this with a lot of high percent of confidence, that MSNBC, which had been on the air for just 2 days, bought this amateur video and aired it. And they aired it for about, maybe a half hour. And when three men in suits came into their office, to their studio, and took every copy they had.
Was this the video that showed something going up toward the plane?
Yes. And, I've talked to at least 100 people who saw this video. And my best witness, though, is a fellow. In fact, I gave his name in a book. I don't need to give it out now. But he was willing to come forward. He was a 747 pilot who was laid up in a Hong Kong hospital at the time with back surgery. And his wife had come out to, to keep him company.
Sure.
And in Hong Kong, he said he watched it steadily for 2 weeks. And he described the scene in detail. And this guy had also been a Boeing engineer working on,
So he knew what he was looking at.
Absolutely knew what he was talking about. And he described it in detail. We're at a deck where people are having a party. Someone says, hey, look at what's going up in the sky. The camera turns to it. It follows the missile up. And then and the description that he gives exactly matches the description that the 258 people who saw what they thought was a missile going up saw. And that is, a burning red tip followed by a smoky gray white contrail, zigzagging out to sea, arcing over, blowing up outside the plane, blowing it out of the sky.
And the government would want you to believe that what you saw on that video was not a missile going up, but jet fuel burning down.
Well, yeah, actually, the government wasn't quite sure what they wanted you to see or what they thought you saw. And this is where the CIA gets involved. And in my book, TW-800, George, the real breakthrough is that private researchers have stumbled and happily shared it with me. A mother load of CIA documents. We knew about the sausage. The sausage at the end is when the CIA creates this animation showing a spontaneous fuel tank explosion, which blows the front end of the plane off. The rest of the plane tilts back and then incredibly zooms up about 3,500 feet. And when they showed that in November 97, the FBI did, closing the criminal case, they made the argument. At first, the CIA made the argument that what the eyewitnesses saw was a plane rocketing upwards, which confused them into thinking they saw a missile. They later finessed that description to what they saw was the leaking fuel falling down,
mm-hmm.
and that's what confused them into thinking they saw a missile. But in fact, what they saw were missiles. They knew up from down. These were sophisticated people.
Now, were these missiles, and we're going to get into some of the new evidence you've uncovered and so many other things here, Jack, but the missiles, were they coming from a small boat down there? Were they coming from this Navy ship? Some people were saying that it was a mistake, that there was a launched missile that hit the plane by error. What do you think?
Well, I follow the evidence where it goes, and I would have felt better had I discovered at the end of the day that it was a terrorist on a small boat out in the Atlantic
mm-hmm.
shooting shoulder fire missiles. The evidence doesn't take us there. The evidence suggests with, I would say, at least 98% confidence, and I'll tell you about new information we've gathered that that backs this.
All right, we'll hold that thought right there, Jack. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll talk about the new evidence. We'll talk about what you think took down TWA Flight 800 as we approach 20 years, folks, 20 years since this tragedy occurred. My gosh, will we ever be the same? It killed 230 people. We'll be back. Hey, August 27th. Talk about good. We've got some great guests for you live in Asheville, North Carolina. And people now are starting to buy tickets from all over the place to come to this quaint theater called the Diana Wortham Theater. So come on by. All the information is at coasttocoastam.com under the highlights. The highlights are the revolving pictures that you see right in the middle of the homepage there. So go there. Pick up your tickets. You can even pick out your own seats. And come on by. We're going to have a great meet and greet afterwards, too, and have some fun. I've not been in Asheville that I can remember. It's been that long. So I'm looking forward to this. So just go to coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Jack Cashel with us. His latest book, TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy. What kind of new evidence, Jack, were you able to unfold here?
Well, we have two major breakthroughs. One is this, I mentioned before, the cache of CIA documents that I'm just shocked they let out. And it tells us, you know, I was telling you earlier about the sausage, that is the animation they made at the end.
Yes.
Now we know how they made the sausage. The second thing we have, and this is my sometimes partner in crime, James Sanders, on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I just got it recently.
How's he doing, by the way? Is he feeling better?
What's that?
Is he feeling better?
He seems to be in good spirits. He's a feisty fighter. I mean, it's
good.
You know, he's been in the trenches on this. When he was arrested and convicted of conspiracy,
yeah.
So, you know, with his wife Elizabeth,
they thought he was tampering with the evidence.
Yeah, which is called reporting. You know,
exactly.
Crime. But he, through Freedom of Information Act, received in the mail this video, and it shows a missile going up, and it's obviously an amateur video, and we hear the videographer. It's a Long Island accent. It's off the south coast of Long Island, and you can't tell whether it's dusk or dawn when you're looking at it. You see a missile going up, and the guy says, "Hey, it looks like there's a rocket going up." And we had known about this video because both the CIA and the FBI talk about it. And then we see some flaming debris come out of the sky. And this video was shot on July 12th, 5 days before the downing of TWA Flight 800. What makes it important is that the FBI had said there was no Navy testing for the two previous years in those waters south of Long Island. And the path of the missile conforms to what the eyewitnesses saw on the night of July 17th. Also, we know from the CIA documents that the missile experts at the Defense Intelligence Agency viewed the video and said, yes, it does look like a surface-to-air missile.
Jeez.
And but in all of the descriptions I had read of this video, no one mentioned what came down. When they talked about the missile, like what it looked like, a missile going up, which could have been, you know, anything. But when you see the flaming debris fall out of the sky, and it's not of the size or magnitude of Flight 800, it's much more likely either another missile, or it's a self-destruct, or it's a drone. But it hit something, and that something fell out of the sky.
In this video, before TWA Flight 800 went down, you're saying?
Right, that's 5 days before.
Okay.
Also, we know this from the CIA documents, and I had this confirmed the other day. By the way, if anyone has inside information, who really knows something and wants to come forward, just go to my website, cashel.com, cashill.com, and it will tell you how to reach me. Because the other day, a woman emails me. She goes, I don't know if this means anything, but on the night of July 7th, my friends and I were camping on the south shore of Long Island, and we looked out to sea around sunset, and we saw this looked like two missiles going up into the air. This is on July 7th, 1996.
10 days before.
Right. Well, now we know from the CIA documents now that multiple people reported that sighting on July 7th.
That's interesting.
So even the CIA says, well, look, we now have sightings on July 7th, July 12th, and July 17th. Now, you don't have to be a math major to know that there's a pattern there, you know?
Now, and you had said before the break, you would have felt better if you had known that there were terrorists out there with shoulder harness missiles.
Right. Then I would have felt that, you know, I would have felt better because I would have not have thought that we did it ourselves accidentally.
And are you leading in that direction?
That's where the evidence goes. And it's not to say there wasn't a terrorist element in the mix. I can't rule that out, that there might have been maybe a small plane that was part of the Bojinka plot.
And Sanders has told us, Jack, that he believes, and you must too then in some form and fashion, that there was a small plane that was going to ram TWA Flight 800 in a suicide mission, and that we picked up on it, and that the missile was intended to take out that small plane and missed. Is that?
I still think that's a real possibility. I would say this though, George, in the 13 years since Sanders and I wrote First Strike, I just haven't found enough confirming evidence for me to get beyond speculation on that.
Okay. Well, what a theory.
The Navy was involved.
To this day,
and
you
the
believe
fact
that?
They were testing that close. They were testing this, it's what's called cooperative engagement capability. And when you look at the evidence, the real giveaway is the position of the Navy P-3 Orion, which was sort of...
And I've flown those. Those are anti-submarine planes.
Right, but what they also are, and I found these illustrations from these technical manuals from that period, they were available to the media in 1996, is you have these CEC engagements, cooperative engagement capability, and what the combatants in this, being the ships and subs, used as the means to convey information among themselves, the P-3, which was right in the center. So I'm looking at these illustrations, and there's the P-3 in every one of them. And they were used, at that time, the Navy was moving from, they were trying to anti-missile missiles, from ship-launched anti-missile missiles. And that was going on at the time. Now, that's not to say that this is what happened. It's just that this is where the evidence leads.
Why not come forward and simply say, we made a tragic mistake?
There's a political element here that has to be factored in. I will just leave it at this. It was an election year. I will say this, is that once you make a decision, and I think this is what happened, is to finesse the outcome. Once you start kicking that can down the road, you can't start kicking it back. So once you take missiles off the table, and the CIA was, and we know this now as a fact, was insinuated into the investigation on day one. They admit it on the first day. The FBI takes over the investigation illegally from the NTSB, but at least they do it publicly.
Yeah.
The CIA moves in covertly. And we know now from their documents that they were calling the shots. And let me give you, for instance, on July 30th, now we're 13 days out, the CIA meets with the FBI missile team. And at this point, the FBI is trying to do a good job. I mean, it's altogether possible. Those first few weeks, the authorities were trying to do a good job, trying to get at the facts, trying not to panic people until they knew what happened, etc. You don't want to go to war with the wrong enemy, or any enemy if it's not an enemy missile. But on July 30th, the FBI missile team meets with the CIA analyst. And I could tell you his name because he's all over the place. His name's Randolph Taus. He wins a medal for his work. And they tell him that they've already interviewed 144 eyewitnesses, mainly professional. These are all quotes. Excellent eyewitnesses, quote. Overwhelming evidence, quote. Too consistent, quote, to be anything but surface-to-air missiles. The CIA analyst boasts to his superior, the names are redacted, that he did his best to discourage the FBI from going forward with this report. Well, the FBI never did go forward with this report. 2 weeks after that, they meet with the New York Times, which has not interviewed an eyewitness yet. And they tell the New York Times, we go in 2 weeks from 144 excellent witnesses, mainly professional, overwhelming evidence, to a handful of credible witnesses. That's what they tell the New York Times. The FBI does. And they present only one of those witnesses for the New York Times to speak with. He's a legitimate fellow. His name's Michael Russell. He's an engineer, and he gives an honest report of what he sees. He's on a trawler out, maybe a mile off the shore, and he sees out of the corner of his eye a bright white flash, suggestive of a high explosion, not a soft, low explosion like a fuel tank. And then he sees the plane immediately fall out of the sky. So the New York Times walks away with two impressions. One is that this virtually rules out the possibility of a missile strike. And B, it increases the possibility that a bomb blew up TWA Flight 800. So within a month, and this the second New York Times article was literally 1 month to the day after the crash, August 17th, the FBI had steered the New York Times, and they spoke almost exclusively to the Times, into believing that a bomb blew up TWA Flight 800. This would culminate 6 days later on August 23rd with an above-the-fold headline in the New York Times, "Prime Evidence Found That Device Exploded in TWA 800 Cabin." Now,
wow.
They're going to have to walk that whole headline back, and they do. But the gist of this article is that there was explosive residue found all over the plane, which was true enough, PETN and RDX, and that it was indicative of a bomb blast, and that that seemed to be the conclusion that the FBI reached about the nature of the destruction of the plane.
But they never went bomb. They never went public with that, though, did they?
Oh, they did go public. That was above the fold headline.
Well, I thought, though, that they pushed the arcing wire in the wing theory that
Would come later.
Ah, okay. Okay.
But for about a month, the public was led to believe that a bomb blew up Flight 800, and every day, this was, by the way, the number one news story of 1996. The Times was running three or four articles a day on it. And every day for roughly a month, the New York Times readers were learning about bomb residue or explosive residue, specifically and very specifically PETN and RDX all over the inside of the plane and even traces on the outside of the plane. And that was the conclusion.
Is that indicative?
But not as scary as missiles.
Jack, is that indicative of a bomb on board as opposed to a missile?
That was what they wanted the public to believe. Yeah,
right.
Bomb on board.
Jeez.
And that's what the public did believe. And bombs you can live with. You know, okay, we'll tighten up our security, and we did. We went into this, security lockdown and new procedures and whatnot.
Well, at what point did they switch it to the mechanical failure of a spark wire in the wing?
That comes on September 19th. There's a first article in the New York Times. Now we're 2 months after the crash.
And how do they change it? How do they go from bomb on board to this?
This is really, I would say, one of the most shocking and corrupt elements of the whole investigation. On September 19th, the New York Times reports the NTSB now is getting back in the picture, and they're saying, we can't rule out a mechanical malfunction because we're not finding any evidence of a bomb. And the New York Times reader has got to be confused. We've just been reading about a bomb.
Right, with residue everywhere.
So then on September 20th, the FBI puts out a press release 1 day later and saying, we're thinking now that because of a dog training exercise.
In St. Louis.
In St. Louis, 6 weeks prior, we now believe that the officer in question was careless and he spilled, trace of explosives all over the plane, and that is what it accounts for the explosive residue we found. Now, the trick is here is that when they run that article, New York Times runs this on September 20th, neither the FBI nor the New York Times had talked to the officer in question. In fact, the first person to talk to that officer was me, 6 years later. They never talked to him. No one in the media ever talked to him, and they bought the story wholesale. Now, here's where it gets really ugly, because now we have to start hurting people. And this is the first person to get hurt. His name is Herman Burnett. He's an African-American. He took it very personally. It kind of ruined his career.
He was a police officer, right?
Yes, yeah, just a regular St. Louis cop.
Matter of fact, he's a brother of a friend of mine, Harvey Burnett, who was a police officer in St. Louis.
In fact, my father was a police officer, so I used my sort of police connections to get a hold of Herman. And, he was distressed because, they had to make a fool out of him to sell this story. All that he listed on his report was the time of the exercise and the notation wide body. That was it. And since this exercise had taken place 6 weeks before the crash and 10 weeks before they talked to him, you know, he had no idea what gate he was at or, you know, what the plane number was. And so we do know this. The FBI lists the time, and they do it honestly. You know, the exercise started at 10:45 a.m., and it finished at 12:15 p.m., 90 minutes later. Burnett did this on a sterile environment, that is, an empty plane, and he placed six training aids at different, a zigzag pattern. Then he goes back, he gets the dog, you know, the dog, you know, sniffs it out, and he regoes and takes him back. He finishes the exercise at roughly 12:15. Here's what we know now, and it was any media person could have figured this out in a day, is that the TWA-800 plane at 12:15 p.m., which is the only evidence we have other than wide body, it has 400 passengers on board. It's backing out of the gate, and it's on its way to Hawaii. Now, even the FBI would acknowledge that the plane left at 12:35, you know, and the exercise finished at 12:15. They don't tell us that why it left at 12:35. It wasn't like they just moved it over to another gate. No. But sitting next to the 800 plane was an empty 747, that, you know, a clone 747 that would not leave for several more hours. In addition to that, and as the Times reported even then, before they just let it go, was that in no way did the training aids match, either in composition or in placement, the explosive residue found on the plane. There's no PETN and RDX. There's no. He had, you know, there's various half a dozen different training aids, but none of them matched, and they were not put in any of the places where the residue was found, including on the wings, which was clearly beyond cargo's skill set, you know, to climb up in the wings and sniff the plane. So the whole thing was a sham. It's a lie that can be disproved in at least three different ways. The media could have disproved it at that time, and they did not even talk to the cop. And as a result, he became a laughingstock in FBI annals. You know, they would tell cargo jokes. Yeah. That stupid cop leaking his chemicals all over the plane. And then I got to call him out on this, Jim Kallstrom, who, you know, I have some respect for because he's done some good things, but he was the head of the FBI.
He's retired now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's the Fox anti-terror guy. He was on the air last night, you know, scolding James Comey for his decision.
About not going after Hillary, okay.
Yeah, that's right. And here he was testifying before Congress, and he goes, at the time, this was James Traficant, a congressman, and they had a serious inquiry into this, maybe in 97, I believe, or 98. And he says, Traficant says, isn't it true that the explosive residues were found in different places than where the training materials were placed? And Kallstrom says, no, we found them exactly on the spot. They were leaking all over the place, leaking bags of training residue, you know, of training aids. And then Burnett gets his letter from the FAA scolding him for, you know, and insisting that they get better training for their cops. And, you know, so you have to go through this whole charade. You begin to hurt people to sell your lies. And that is, I find, just inexcusable.
And here we are, Jack, 20 years later, still without definitive answers. We've got answers from good researchers like you. Are we ever going to get to the bottom of this? Like you said earlier, if we don't get it pretty soon, it's going to be gone.
Well, that's why, you know, I'm encouraged, George, because in the last 2 weeks I've been talking about this book, I get a breakthrough a day.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I get a... Because I give out, you know, if, like I said, just go to Cashel.com.
And does it corroborate your thoughts about the Navy missile?
It corroborates my thoughts that there is a massive cover-up. So few people know the whole picture. And that's what, you know, the skeptics would say, well, why doesn't someone come forward and say what they saw? Well, because people only see a little teeny piece.
Yeah, it's in peace. Jack, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back, talk more about this. Plus, the phone lines are now open. Jack Cashel with us. TWA 800 is his latest work.